This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The Equal Rights Amendment, first proposed to Congress in 1923, sought to enshrine in the Constitution equal legal rights for all citizens, regardless of sex, to end the legal distinctions drawn between genders in matters of divorce, property, employment, and so on. It never won the support of enough states needed for ratification. The last really big push, the headline-grabbing effort, was in the early 70s, a moment that saw the rising influence of what's called second-wave feminism, a movement and a set of ideas that took off in the early 60s and seemed to both seep into the culture and to peter out sometime in the 80s. Davi Waller is the creator, showrunner, and executive producer of Mrs. America, that showcases the political fight over the ERA between the mothers of the movement, Betty Friedan, Gloria Steinem, Bella Abzug, and Shirley Chisholm, and its fiercest opponent, the veritable Mrs. America, Phyllis Schlafly. It's a brilliant and accurate piece of work, currently airing on Hulu. You know, I'm really glad through the miracle of Zoom that I got the opportunity to see you, because now I know that you are not of my generation. You were previously a writer on AMC's Mad Men. Now you've done Mrs. America. Why is this era so interesting to you?
I think I'm really drawn to eras of social upheaval and disruption, because there's always so much fallout, and in the fallout lies a lot of drama, particularly the backlash to the women's liberation movement.
Backlash to everything that was going on in the 70s.
The fact that I was so excited to write for Mad Men, I think, speaks to my interest in this time period and particularly the gender dynamics. I think what excited me about Miss America was bringing the women, the Jones and the Peggys, to the forefront of the story and really centering it on them. There really isn't, I don't think, one scene in Miss America that doesn't have a woman in it. The other big difference is, of course, this is a true story. And I learned very quickly that writing a true story, even though you're fictionalizing and imagining a lot of the conversations, is a whole other ballgame.
But in your depiction of the fight over the ERA and the fight for women's rights in general in the 1970s, you don't start with Betty Friedan or Gloria Steinem. You start with Phyllis Schlafly.
I am not against women succeeding. I am not against women working outside the home. That's their choice. But what I am against is a small, elitist group of Northeastern establishment liberals putting down homemakers.
So many shows and films about social movements are told from the point of view of the leaders of the social change movement, never from the point of view of the leader of the opposition to it. The other reason that I really was committed, you know, following the 2016 election, to telling the story from Phyllis's point of view, even though it had its challenges, was because I realized following the election that this story was about much more than the Equal Rights Amendment battle. It was a much broader story about how this country took a sharp turn right at the end of the 70s and the ascendancy of the new right.
It is true that as you tell the story, it's clear that for Schlafly and for the nation, it wasn't solely about women's rights, but about the fight over the soul of the Republican Party and the solidifying of the conservative movement and the future direction of the nation.
You've been trying to get a far-right candidate into the White House since Goldwater. Reagan challenges Ford, and suddenly you're growing your power base, forming alliances with other conservative churches, Mormons.
Well, with the direction the country is going, I think I need all the help I can get.
And I think that you are using the fight over women's equality to build a mailing list of women who would support a conservative presidential candidate like Reagan.
Barry Goldwater, who Phyllis wrote a biography of, and she was a huge fan of his, and he had that stunning defeat in 1964, he said in an interview in the late 60s that the far right of the country, the conservatives, are in a minority in both parties, and they needed to take over one party if they were ever going to have power. Hmm. So this really is about the right wing of this country amassing power, and Phyllis Schlafly's story dovetails into that. She raised a grassroots army that became foot soldiers in the Reagan Revolution.
Was there a scene that was particularly hard to convey?
All the scenes where we had to depict the ERA ratification process were very challenging.
And yesterday, the Equal Rights Amendment sailed through the Senate.
That's right. Hawaii ratified less than 30 minutes after the Senate vote. Delaware, New Hampshire will have it ratified by tomorrow.
We have 7 years, but we'll get it done in one.
It's not an easy process to understand. Like, how are we going to explain to audiences without it sounding like we're laying pipe what exactly this crazy process is you have to go through to get an amendment into the Constitution?
You know, that is totally not the answer that I expected to that question. But I figured that it might be the complexity of the character of Phyllis Schlafly, because she's fiery, she's educated, and she rises by fighting the kinds of policies that would have afforded more opportunities to women like her. She never wrote memoir, as you say, and you get to see her in her public life, but you depict her at home, a really compelling balancing act between submission and domination and love and resentment.
There is a ton of footage of Phyllis Schlafly. I mean, she kept copious videos of every public appearance she made. There isn't that much footage of her in her private life, although there are some old films that she took in her house, you know, in the 50s. But one of her biographers, Carol Felsenthal, wrote a really intimate biography of her and spent time in her house with her children, with her sister-in-law and her husband, and interviewed all of them. She came on as a consultant of the show, and I spent a lot of time talking with her. And that really gave us a glimpse into her private life in a way that the video footage just can't. At the end of it, it is invention. You can't ever know what conversations happened behind closed doors or can't get inside her head. You know, no one can, not even her children, can get really inside her head or know what she was feeling. So that's the work of the writer. I think the reason I didn't bring it up as the hardest scenes to write is because those complexities are what bring me joy as a writer.
What do you think that the ERA meant to women on both sides of the argument back then?
You know, for progressive women, suffrage had given them the vote, but had not given them equality in the law. There was still rampant discrimination. There still is today in the workplace, in marriage laws, in family law.
I certainly was alive and working at a time when wives couldn't apply for their own credit card.
I know, even as far as 1971, which is so insane to think about. So I think for young women in the early 70s, the ERA was a chance to rectify that, to say once and for all that in the Constitution, men and women are equal under the law, which means that no law can discriminate on the basis of your gender. And the truth is that equality for women under the law shouldn't be threatening to anyone, really.
Well, it did start as a bipartisan idea, which might surprise some people.
Republicans supported it and Democrats. Nixon endorsed it. It was looking to get ratified, they thought, within a year or two. And what Phyllis did was she tapped into anxieties that a lot of traditional conservative women had about becoming invisible in a society where women are entering the workforce and being a stay-at-home wife and mother is no longer the feminine ideal. By taking the ERA and saying it's going to make your husband leave you for someone younger and you'll be without any financial support and you're going to be forced into the workforce and forced to work even though your only skill is taking care of your house. And this terrified these women. And so they began to see the Equal Rights Amendment as very threatening. And I have sympathy for that. Ironically, though, Phyllis, in the course of this ERA battle, empowered these women to become political activists and gave them many skills that would help them become very successful in the workforce.
I think a lot of people would be surprised that Schlafly was dedicated to issues of national security. She was worried about Soviet aggression.
The U.S. delegation has naively been telling the Russians, you know, peace is wonderful, try it, you'll like it, it's like life cereal. But I think they're going to get the last laugh because the only country that's going to comply with the pact is the United States.
They don't comply, we'll know, won't we? The experts maintain we have the most advanced satellite technology systems.
Phyllis had a 20-year career in defense policy. She got her master's in Harvard. She studied military strategy and nuclear policy. And she was very terrified of nuclear annihilation at the hands of the Russians. And in 1971, 72, when the ERA is making its way through Congress, she's very focused on Nixon signing the SALT Treaty, and she felt this would be a disaster. You know, when she was interviewed during this time period, people would interview her about the Equal Rights Amendment, and she always said, well, I hope this thing is settled soon so I can get back to defense policies.
The stories that occur in the series, housewives who become working women in launching the Eagle Forum, like Alice, played by Sarah Paulson, we see her go through a transition.
I wanted to ask why we're opposing all of the feminist resolutions. We're not anti-employment or education or minority women. I'm not saying that we shouldn't fight for what we believe in, but shouldn't we try to find consensus about something?
I assume that that is a story arc that you created for the series.
While her specific arc was created for the series, two of the real women that inspired her composite character were neighbors of Phyllis. So one of her neighbors was a member of NOW and really couldn't stand Phyllis and would have like NOW meetings in her home just to upset Phyllis. But another neighbor came at the movement much later and said, you know, for 25 years, I did exactly as Phyllis had prescribed for me. I polished my silver and I washed my floors and I waxed, the, you know, everything. And it wasn't enough. I mean, I'm paraphrasing her. And she ended up joining NOW in the late 70s and she opened up a pro-ERA headquarters right across the street from Fred Schlafly's law firm. There were a ton of women, even conservative women, who ended up joining NOW. And we felt that that was worth exploring. And we had the freedom to do so because unlike the real life characters, we can actually have an arc for Alice, have her go on a journey. And in many ways, I think for a lot of audiences, she is the audience's way into Phyllis's world.
Another great character, brilliantly cast, Elizabeth Banks as Jill Ruckelshaus. She is the Republican force behind the passage of the ERA. Her environment is Capitol Hill.
Do you know what I had to do to get my commission funded? I had to let more than a dozen congressmen put a hand on my arm, my hip, my backside. More than a dozen demanded to see my pretty smile before they agreed to sign on. I had to say, you'd be our hero, and you have so much clout, more times than I can remember. And that is nothing compared to what those secretaries on the Hill are dealing with on a daily basis.
You didn't speak to Jill, but she wrote a book about this.
What I really loved about Jill Ruckelshaus is she came to the women's movement in a way that felt really relatable, you know, that she was a housewife and she had five kids and she was maintaining the home and she read The Feminine Mystique. There's an every woman quality to her, which I really loved. And ultimately, we wanted to tell a story of the battle for the soul of the Republican Party through her eyes and Phyllis's eyes. The party that she loved to be a part of and was so proud of let her down. And given that I had no idea there were feminist leaders who were staunch Republicans, I was fascinated to learn about her.
One of the scenes in your series that really got to me is when Schlafly and her husband debate a feminist couple, man and woman, on the Tomorrow Show. And she makes up a court case.
Under our current system, in a case of a breakup of marriage, the mother gets the children. Now, who wants to trade that in for a so-called equality whereby each parent gets one child.
The ERA does not say that in the case of divorce, each parent gets one child.
Oh, yes, it does. It says the courts would decide, as they did with a recent Washington, D.C. case, where three children were given to the father and the mother had to pay child support.
What was the name of the case?
Crazy to say that was an advance for women. But the larger issue is that the ERA erodes the institution of marriage, not just in divorce.
Cite
the case. Well, I'd have to look it up. But the point is...
You don't know the name of the case?
Well, there's so many cases. We don't have time to...
She and Fred would bring up court cases in that debate that didn't actually relate to what they're discussing or didn't actually support their argument. So the actual case that she brings up was invented in our writer's room. We simplified it because, you know, that debate is an hour long and we only had 5 minutes of airtime. But I think more damaging is taking facts and then distorting them in such a way that they appear or seem to be true or sound true, but aren't.
Oh, you mean like her version of deepfake, when she literally takes the remarks of Bella Abzug and edits them to make her say things she hasn't actually said?
Don't people realize that most women are working to destroy the home, family, and religion?
But that's not exactly what she said in her speech.
Yes, but she said those words.
Yes, but in a different way. You're just taking them out of context.
The Horribles tape is a real tape. It wasn't Phyllis who actually mixed it together, but she was the one who passed it along and got it, basically contributed to going viral through the churches. We couldn't get our hands on the actual tape, but what we read about it is that they would pull together sermons from evangelical ministers, and then they took feminist speeches out of context and strung them together to terrify, you know, women across America to join their cause.
Max Boot wrote in the Washington Post about your series. He is a Bush-era conservative who has now become quite liberal in the Trump era. And he writes that Mrs. America doesn't actually show how extreme Schlafly's own views were, that she was, in fact, a John Birch Society member until the mid-60s. Were you trying to temper Schlafly in any way?
No, I was not trying to temper Schlafly. We have a whole legal team at FX that's vetting everything. We have to make sure that if we say something on the show that there's evidence, especially that kind of allegation. And we did not come up with anything that could confirm without a shadow of a doubt that she was a John Birch Society member. But it was a very right-wing, anti-communist organization, and many of its members were very active in the backlash against the civil rights movement, and it was comprised of many segregationists. Although, by all accounts, it appears that she, Fred, and Eleanor were Birchers. To have it come out of her mouth, you have to be very sure and have the evidence. But, and we show this in the episode entitled Bella, she never denounced the Klan either. If you truly find them abhorrent, you don't just deny association with them as she did. You would denounce them.
Before the final credits, there comes a montage with some updates about the ERA and the feminist movement. And it says, the leaders of the women's movement continue to fight for gender equality, but they never again reach the political influence they had in the early 70s. But would we have the moment we're having now if we didn't have the moments back in the 70s?
You know, you notice I said political influence, not cultural influence, because I do think that their cultural influence was vast. And if you look at the culturally where this country is, they won. And all the things that Phyllis tried to get everyone fearful of, if you pass the ERA, happened anyway. Gay marriage, women in combat, unisex bathrooms. But legislatively, I don't think they ever had the kind of advances that they had in that short time period from 1970 to 1973. When you look at what they did in Congress in those 2 years and Roe v. Wade in the courts, and we still don't have a female president 50 years later. You know, Shirley Chisholm runs in 1972. They're all saying like, well, it's a little too soon, but definitely by 1980, we'll have a female president and Congress will be half women. And now they seem crazy for thinking that. But in many ways, the backlash was very successful.
Let me ask you a little bit about the race divide in the movement. That never went away either. There still are arguments about priorities among feminists of different races.
There are still many problems today in terms of intersectional feminism. I think I was surprised at the blind spots that existed in the 70s. You know, intersectional feminism wasn't even a term then. But I don't see how you can even make an argument that you can talk about sexism without talking about racism, or that you can talk about sexism without talking about homophobia. And so even though we still grapple with these issues today, I do think as a movement, they have come a long way.
There are many people who say that the advances on racism that America set in motion in the 60s never really bore fruit. And you might be able to say that about sexism as well, depending on how you measure progress. But as you say, you know, if there's a cultural change, sometimes political change lags by a generation or more. Where do you think things stand today?
I definitely think things are better in regards to sexism. If for no other reason, we're all hyper aware of it in a way that the sort of casual sexism that no one even paid attention to is just so pervasive and so in the fabric of everyday life that you wouldn't even note it. Now we pick up on all the microaggressions. There's definitely been progress. I think my biggest takeaway working on the show is that it's not as fast as I would like, and it's not linear. And that we take a step forward and there's a step back. And I think the more we can learn about when the backlash happens, how it happens, maybe the next time there's a backlash, we can anticipate it better and it won't have the same effect.
Davi, thank you so much.
Thank you, Breck. Stay safe.
Davi Waller is the creator, showrunner, and executive producer of Mrs. America, airing on Hulu and FX. Hope you like the Pod Extra. Thanks for listening. You can check out The Big Show on Friday, sometime around dinner time. Bye.